Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the first day of April. Yesterday, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued their latest report, and it is alarming. It shows that climate change is already affecting every continent and ocean, posing immediate and growing risks to people. The report says the longer that society delays steps to cut the release of planet-warming greenhouse gases, the more severe and widespread the harm will be. Nobody on this planet, the report says, is going to be untouched by the impacts of climate change. Here in the United States, the battle over the Keystone XL pipeline has gone on for well over 2 years now. And we asked the question what the president is likely to do on this issue and what would be the impact on climate warming in this country and in the world if the Keystone XL pipeline if there's a go-ahead given to build that. Bill McKibben is our guest today. We're delighted to have Bill with us. Bill is an author and environmentalist. His 1989 book, The End of Nature, was regarded as the first book for a general audience about climate change. He's founder of 350.org, a planet-wide climate change movement, which really is taking place all over this earth. He's a distinguished scholar in environmental studies at Middlebury College. Last year won the Gandhi Prize and the Thomas Merton Prize. Was named by Foreign Policy as one of the world's 100 most important global thinkers. He writes for many publications around the world, and his latest book, we interviewed him on this a little while ago, is Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Bill, and I would imagine they'll get fairly crowded as the hour goes on. Keystone XL is our focus, but many of you may have paid special attention to that report that was issued yesterday and would like to comment on that as well. And feel free to do so. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Bill McKibben, a pleasure to have you on the air again. Hello.
It's so good to be on with you as always. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, except it's a little cold. But, you know, the weather is pretty weird here, Bill.
It's been a weird year everywhere, at least across this continent. It's incredible. California's had the driest weather they've ever recorded. Up in Alaska, it's been the warmest weather they ever recorded. I don't know about you guys, but we've had a hell of a cold winter in Vermont because all that Arctic air came seeping down here and what they kept calling the vortex. And, you know, it's been wild all around, and it's not just on the 1.5% of the Earth's surface that's the continental U.S. It's the whole darn shooting match is pretty strange these days.
Was there anything new to your eyes and ears in the U.N. Intergovernmental Panel report that was issued yesterday, Bill?
Well, I mean, in one sense, there's not that much new because they've been saying this now for more than two decades. I mean, I wrote the first book about all this back in 1989, and unfortunately, it's basically everything's following script. I think what's new is that the scientists are just they're in their patient, rational, scientific way, trying hard to figure out why it is that no one ever does anything about these warnings, and so they work hard to figure out some new way to say it that might somehow catch our attention.
All right, and let's get a new phone line for you so that you can catch our attention because the phone is a little scratchy here. Bill McKibben is our guest, and we're going to move into a discussion of the Keystone XL pipeline as we talk with Bill. He really takes the president to task for not making what he thinks is an obvious decision, that the decision to build the pipeline, he says, is one with profound physical consequences, and says that far more of the dirtiest oil on Earth will flow out of the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, and reach the U.S. Gulf Coast. And he specifically mentions global warming, that it will add to global warming in a significant way. But the Pew Research Center shows that the majority of people in this country approve of the pipeline. And the State Department, I'm sure you're aware, had a report that said that there would not be significant environmental damage, although there was some question about who wrote the report and what special interests may have been behind that report. But Bill makes a valid point here. What is it, after two decades of talking about this, two decades after writing his book, why is it that we don't have anything that has captured our attention on this? And Bill, let me ask you why it is that we haven't. I mean, these reports are dire, for heaven's sake, and we're seeing some of the effects of global warming, and yet nothing seems to have grabbed everybody's attention. Why? Oh, he's on another line now. Here we go. There we go. Okay.
it has grabbed people's attention. People know that it's going on. It's, you know, the polling data shows that people are alarmed. But my sense is that an awful lot of people think there's nothing that can be done. And I think they think that not because there's no technology. By now, everybody's seen a windmill or a solar panel. I think people are resigned to the idea that the fossil fuel industry so dominates our political life that they won't let anything happen. Mm. And, there's some truth to that. That's why we've been trying hard to build this movement over the last few years, with one of its, you know, one battle being this fight over the Keystone Pipeline, and others over fracking and over coal ports and Pacific Northwest and mountaintop removal mining. And that's just in this country. You know, our 350.org colleagues in Australia today are being arrested trying to block a vast new coal mine there, and the same all over the planet. Movement's building, but whether or not it's built in time to deal with the science, that's what sends me scared to bed some nights, I gotta say, Kathleen.
Yeah. There have been some interesting responses. Forward.com had a piece last week talking about recent events in the Ukraine making blocking the pipeline that much more difficult because Russia provides over half of Europe's oil. What do you make of that latest argument? We have to have the pipeline because of what's going on with Russia.
I think it's as absurd as every other attempt like this. If this is our method to fight the Russians, then we're in real trouble. The Russians are exactly the same people who want to build the pipeline, say Rex Tillerson, CEO of Exxon, who last summer accepted the Order of Friendship Medal from none other than Vladimir Putin. This is just one more scam to try and keep doing what Big Oil wants to do and try to keep people from interfering in any way. The conventional wisdom has always been that this is going to get built, and the conventional wisdom may be right. Oil and gas and coal production in the U.S. have skyrocketed during the Obama years. We're turning into the biggest exporter, biggest producer of oil and gas in the world. We're going to pass Saudi Arabia and Russia during the Obama years. So, yeah, there's every reason to think that he might approve this too, except that we've mounted as fierce a defense as we can, and we will keep doing it.
When is he going to make a decision about this?
You're asking the wrong person. He can do it at any moment or never. And I have no insight. You know what? The last time I was inside the White House was on a tour when I was in the sixth grade. I've been arrested twice being chained to the outside of it, but that doesn't give me any inside information about what's going on in there.
If you were to have the great privilege of writing his statement and he decided not to go ahead with construction of this, you have said if the president were to become the first world leader to block a big energy project on the grounds of its effects on climate, what would he say about its effects on climate?
I think what he would say is this is one of many things that we need to do to try and keep our climate situation from getting out of control. Let this be an example for other leaders around the world of my willingness to stand up to the oil interests and the money interests and stop something in its tracks. We're all getting together in Paris in 2015, all of us world leaders, to try and take up where we failed in Copenhagen in 2009. None of us had the guts then to do anything bold or broad. In fact, not to do anything at all. We need other people to show some guts now, even in the face of political pressure from the richest industry on earth. So here's my stab at it. Let's see China and Europe up the ante on me now.
Mm. And you talked about these interests. Who are they? Are they big oil companies?
Well,
Exxon,
let's talk about some people you guys know pretty well in Wisconsin.
All right.
The Koch brothers.
Mm-hmm.
The one estimate I've seen from a California think tank is that the Keystone Pipeline would produce $100 billion, up to $100 billion for the Koch brothers over its 40-year lifetime. So if you guys enjoy all the fun and hijinks that you get when they have a lot of money to spend on things, and you've seen it up close and personal in Wisconsin over the last few years, then you probably want to make sure they keep getting funded by building more pipelines.
What's interesting, and I wasn't aware of this until you wrote about it, is that the president's former communications director, Anita Dunn, is now, you say, on the TransCanada dime.
Washington is so wired to do this, so it's everyone, not just Obama's people. Hillary's deputy campaign manager from her last run for president became TransCanada's chief lobbyist in Washington, not, I'm guessing, because of his incredible knowledge of how pipelines work, but because of his knowledge about how political pipelines work. The State Department approval process was, it's one of those rocks that some days I wish we'd never turned over, because it was so discouraging to see what the hell was underneath, just endless emails from State Department employees cheering on the pipeline companies and every kind of conflict of interest. And it's this stuff's sad. The only good news is that everybody in D.C. said in 2011 that TransCanada would have their permit by the end of the year. That was the strong consensus. National Journal polled 300 of their energy insiders, and that's what 91% of them said. They don't have it yet. They've got an awful lot of pipe sitting in lots across the U.S., vacant fields across the U.S. just rusting. And with any luck, it'll stay there.
There also have been some concerns raised by members, I believe, of some Native American tribes in South Dakota and elsewhere who have said that they were not consulted and that this pipeline would be disturbing some of their ancestral graveyards. Isn't that right?
The real leaders of this fight all along have been, the two groups that have really done the heaviest lifting are Native Americans on both sides of the border, and ranchers and farmers, especially in Nebraska, but all along the pipeline route. And they're both groups are coming together in Washington later this month. They're going to have an encampment on the Mall in Washington, out there in tents and teepees and things. And I think they might be riding on horseback up to the gates of the White House. That's really appropriate because these are the people who we need to start listening to. These are the people that we count on to grow our food in a world where, as the IPCC said Monday, that's getting extremely hard. And these are the people, Native Americans, whose wisdom and understanding about the continent they've inhabited far longer than the rest of us, we have steadfastly ignored for a very long time and ignored to our peril. Might be time, actually, to start paying a little attention.
Hmm. Well, some have said that we already have pipelines all over, crisscrossing this whole country. What is it that's so potentially damaging about the Keystone?
Well, on its route, it goes in a new place. It heads right across the Oglala Aquifer and, cuts a new hypotenuse across the heartland. But the other thing that's really damaging about it is that it's the first big pipeline up into the tar sands, and it'll provide the capital for them to go on expanding this thing, unless it's blocked, at which point the expansion of that tar sands project up north will begin to slow. It's not like we're going to stop climate change by stopping it, but if we don't stop it, it's one more thing that makes it all but impossible to deal with the crisis we've stumbled into.
And what's happened, we've talked about this many times before, but what's happened to the whole movement that everybody keeps espousing whenever we have any kind of energy crisis, and now we've got a climate change crisis, to move toward a different kind of energy, to move toward sustainable energy? Are we investing in that at all, Bill?
Well, the good news is we know how to do it, and the few places that have really made the effort, man, it's astonishing to see. There were days the past summer when Germany generated more than half the power it used from solar panels within its borders, and days during the winter when half of its power is coming from wind.
Hmm.
This is good. What it reflects is not that Germany is an immensely sunny place, because it isn't. It's kind of Wagnerian and foggy. What it reflects is that they have a great deal of political will. What it also reflects is the utter lack of political will in a country like ours. Think what a nation that had, you know, assets like California and Florida and Arizona could be doing in terms of solar power, but isn't doing in any huge scale yet, because we haven't, well, because we haven't bucked the power of the fossil fuel industry.
Bill McKibben is our guest. We're talking about yesterday's report from the United Nations that was alarming once again, as all these reports have been for a long, long time, concerning climate change, the impact that we're feeling now, and the fact that everybody on Earth will experience impact before you know it. We're also looking at the Keystone XL pipeline, which is an issue that Bill has been working on for a long, long time. The battle, as he says, has worn on for well over 2 years and illuminated the Obama presidency like no other. The president can make this decision. He makes the decision whether or not this will be built. State Department issued a report saying go ahead, which Bill will take issue with in greater detail as the conversation goes on. And we're looking at the opposition to Bill's idea to stop this, a coalition of Exxon, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Royal Dutch Shell, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, the Business Roundtable, sending the president a letter demanding that he approve Keystone in order to maintain investor confidence. He will make a decision sometime during this year. We don't know when. What do you think the decision should be and why? Here's how you reach our conversation. 1-800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Bill has been involved in the issue of climate change for a long time. His first book in 1989, The End of Nature. His latest book is Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. And he is the founder of this planet-wide organization, 350.org. It is a climate change movement. To your phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Keystone XL Pipeline is what we're talking about this hour, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. For Bill McKibben, we go to Lawrence in La Crosse first. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi, Bill. Well, I live in La Crosse. We have a Burlington Northern Railway track that goes right through the middle of town. And guess what's on that track? Oil trains with hundreds of cars coming from up north.
Yes.
Now, do you think it's better to have that oil travel on these trains? If they derail, they'd go right into the Mississippi River.
Nope. I think it's better to not have it come out of the ground at all. And all the economic modeling shows that if we're able to stop the pipeline, we'll stop the expansion, or at least the rapid expansion of the tar sands, and hence the total amount of oil coming out of there, however it's coming, will be reduced. They'll continue to get some out by rail, but it's much more expensive for them to do it. And so with any luck, the whole project will begin to dwindle. On the other hand, if the pipeline goes forward, then the plans are to triple or quadruple the size of the tar sands patch up there, and I think you can expect a lifetime full of rail cars coming by your door. It's not just that the oil go into the river. It also represents a real possibility of dangerous explosion. We saw what happened in Quebec about a year ago with a oil train. So the goal is to get off this damn stuff altogether, and we can't do it by building new pipelines.
Can you explain a little bit more fully what the tar sands oil is? What's tar sands, Bill?
Sure. So this is not. Here's what it's not.
Okay.
Remember that scene in the Beverly Hillbillies where the guy like shoots into the ground and up comes the bubbling crude, black gold, Texas tea. That's not what we're talking about here. This is tar sand. It's oil heavily mixed in with sand, and hence no one really ever thought you'd be able to get it out of the ground until the price of oil got high enough that it became sort of economical to go burn huge amounts of natural gas underground and heat it so that it would sort of flow. And if you keep a pipeline heated all the time, you can keep this sludgy stuff flowing down to the refinery. Because you've burnt all that natural gas to get at it, this is the most energy-intensive oil on Earth. It has a higher carbon footprint even than normal oil, which is what's driven most of the climatic damage that we've seen so far. So this stuff's even worse. It has earned its nickname as the dirtiest oil on Earth.
Let's go next to Carol in Oak Creek. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you very much. I heard some troubling news on NPR, your radio station, the other day, that they want to ship these oil tar sands from Canada and load them on barges in Lake Superior to refineries along the Great Lakes. Now, if there's an oil spill with these tar sands, we have no way to clean it up because these tar sands sink. The technology does not exist to clean up these tar sands on the Great Lakes. And you know how deep Lake Superior is. That's absolutely right.
And you can talk to your neighbors in Michigan about it. The Kalamazoo River had a spill of these tar sands from a pipeline, and it's never recovered. There's still sections that are closed, and I think they'll never be able to get that. You're absolutely right. This stuff sinks. It doesn't float. It's not just the barges. There's plans to run the tar sands under that through that pipeline, long existing pipeline that runs under the Mackinac Straits Bridge up there between Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. And it's all craziness. But there's no way out of that craziness as long as we remain dependent on this stuff, dependent in a way that we no longer need to be. We've got the technologies now to move us into a new clean energy future, and the only reason that we're not taking full advantage of them is because people like the Koch brothers the Koch brothers are the largest landowners up there in the tar sands. There's several trillion dollars worth of this gunk up there, and they're determined to get their hands on it.
Thanks, Carol. Phyllis in Waupaca. Hi.
Hi. Someone told me that there's an area, something like 56,000 square miles. They said it was the area as large as the state of Florida that looks like a moonscape, that all the trees and the top of the ground has been leveled. And is that correct information?
You should go up there and see it. If you can't go up, you should go on Google Earth and look at it because it's, for Tolkien fans, a technical description of the tar sands country up there would be Mordor. This place is, I went up there last summer for this, what they call a healing walk that the Native First Nations groups put on. And we camped in their gorgeous boreal forest, and then we walked into the, spent a day or two walking across one part of this vast tar sands complex. Bear in mind, they've only gotten about 3% of the oil out, but they've already, created what's got to be just about the biggest, ugliest scar on Earth. And, it is truly ugly. You get up there, and there are these huge tailings ponds where the water is held back that's been so polluted in the course of mining this stuff. And if any bird ever lands in that water, it is a dead duck. And so they fire cannon day and night, every few seconds. Boom,
ooh,
boom,
ooh,
boom. to keep birds from landing. It's literally as if there is a war underway against nature up there. And I'm afraid nature is not faring very well.
Thank you, Phyllis. Let's go to Mark, Richland Center. Hi, Mark.
Hello, thank you for the program. The statement that you made a minute ago is that we do have alternative technologies. We do have other ways of producing energy. The liquid fuel side of it is a little bit different because liquid fuel is used for transportation. But in Germany, producing electricity that comes from fossil fuels, 50% of that is presently produced from solar energy. The problem that we have in this country is that getting the utilities to buy the electricity the way they do it in Germany at three times the market rate hasn't been doable. But in Boulder, people simply had installed so many solar panels that the electric utility was upset they were losing business, and they tried to stop further installation of panels so that the people in Boulder simply bought the electric utility with intent to close it. So if these utilities that are publicly owned could be bought by we the people with intent to close them because they're using fossil fuels, we could achieve the same thing that Germany's done. The problem we have in some places, like in Arizona, they're trying to stop the installation of further solar panels. And so we've got to find a different strategy than simply trying to get the utilities, who are basically at odds with us, from buying electricity that we would produce ourselves.
Yeah, that's quite true. And for instance, Arizona and a number of other states where Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers group, is trying to roll back the small renewable energy standards we have so that nothing will stand in the way of continuing to expand the fossil fuel enterprise. But you're right, there's no reason to keep doing it, and there's no reason to allow utilities, which after all are supposed to operate in the public interest and have earned their shareholders huge amounts of money over the years, no reason to let them dictate our policy. They will dictate our policy unless we build a movement. That's what we're trying to do. The good news, as you point out, is that the technology is there, even for transportation. I mean, let's lay aside for a moment the really smart transportation ideas like public transportation and trains. Even if we're going to stay stuck on cars, I have a Ford plug-in hybrid in the garage, and I have solar panels on my roof. And the first 30 miles or so a day, which most days is all that I ever use, it comes from the sun. No problem.
Thanks very much for the call. Now, this has been suggested. Give me your thoughts on this. As we know, we live in incredibly partisan times. The president has talked about how his decision will be dependent on whether or not we're adding to our carbon footprint in any substantial way. Someone has suggested that what we need to do is give Paul Ryan and John Boehner some room to maneuver here. The president would say, all right, let's build the Keystone, but we need some indication from you that we're going to act on reducing our carbon footprint in other ways. We're going to take meaningful congressional action. We're going to have to make sure that our automobile standards are much higher than they are, power plants, et cetera, throw in something else. It would enable him, the suggestion is, to keep his promise to approve Keystone. It would create jobs, which Republicans are saying would be the outcome of Keystone, and would get everybody a win on this issue.
Everyone except the planet. Look, if you look at the experience of the last 5 or 6 years, there's no such thing as negotiations in good faith in Washington. The president, I think, did actually come in thinking that he was going to bargain with Republicans and give them some of this and some of that. And whenever he did, he got absolutely nothing in return. And he'll get nothing in return for this. The Congressional Republican Party is owned by the fossil fuel industry. Every time there's been a vote on, say, Keystone, one can predict with unerring accuracy who will vote in what way, depending on how much money they've taken from the fossil fuel industry. It's an even better predictor than party lines, and there's plenty of Democrats who are just as implicated in this kind of foolishness as the Republicans. So, I think there's actually a chance for the president to change the dynamic here and do something that actually gets something done for once.
Mm. Tell me a little more, Bill, about 350.org. You have built one very impressive organization all over the world.
Well, it's mostly been built by young people who are just astonishing. We started it 6 years ago with myself and seven undergraduates at Middlebury College in Vermont. And now it's, you say, expanded to the point where we've organized about 20,000 demonstrations in every country except North Korea. And the people who work for it, almost all of them, like me, volunteers, are astonishing. To see people, Kathleen, in the poorest countries in the world who have done nothing to cause this problem and yet are willing to work with people in the West who have done everything to cause this problem, that moves me every time. When I get, you can tell from listening to me that I wrote a book called The End of Nature. You know, I'm prone to a certain amount of despair,
right,
cynicism, all kinds of unhealthy mental habits. But when I talk to those people, when I see the pictures pouring in from Bangladesh and Rwanda, wherever, every time we do a day of action, then I know that I can keep on doing this stuff too. And in fact, it's a hell of a lot of fun to do it a lot of the time. It feels like the fight of our time. And is it an earlier age, the fights of the day were to stop fascism in Europe or to stop segregation in the South. Ours is to stop fossil fuel combustion on the face of the earth and give this poor old planet some hope of limping through.
Mm. And would you say, the report yesterday talked about how rich and poor countries are suffering from this, rich countries more financially. Poor countries are suffering because the water levels and their health is suffering, and even having availability access to their own land. Can you talk more about how this is impacting countries like Bangladesh?
Yeah, as a general rule, you don't want to be low to the water right now because water is rising. Ocean water is rising. You don't want to be in a place that's arid because deserts are expanding. You don't want to be in a place that's really prone to heavy rain because those places, since as water evaporates in the arid ones, it collects in the atmosphere and then rains down, those places are seeing ever heavier rainfall. But what you really don't want to be is in a poor place that has no margin at all to deal with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Hurricane Sandy comes to the U.S. It's horrible. The New York City subway system is underwater, that's about as disaster movie bad as you can get. But we're rich enough for the moment that Washington can cut a check for $60 billion to help New York recover. The U.S. government spent more money in 2012 on Sandy and the Midwest drought than it did on education. Okay, but we were able to do that because we have some money. You go to the Philippines, okay, and Typhoon Haiyan comes aboard. Well, A, everybody lives in substandard housing to begin with because they're poor, and B, the government does not have money to cut everyone a check. So there's still, our 350 leaders in the Philippines say there's still several million people without proper homes as in the aftermath of that typhoon.
Mm.
The poorest people in the world, the one thing they've always been able to depend on is the basic physical stability of the planet. If you could grow corn in your field, your grandson or granddaughter would be able to do it. Well, that's a sucker's bet now. We've taken away just even that most basic of margins from the poorest people on the planet, and so we sure as hell owe it to them to do whatever we can to keep the planet from deteriorating further and to make them as whole as we can against that loss. One of the things that was interesting about that IPCC report is that apparently until the last day, it called for $100 billion in aid from rich countries to poor countries to deal with climate change. That was the figure that Secretary of State Clinton promised in Copenhagen, $100 billion a year. But the U.S. apparently demanded that that part be taken out before the final report was issued.
Monday morning in Japan. And it's because apparently we've now decided that we're too poor in the Western world to live up to any kind of obligations to the rest of the planet. Mm. Hurricane Sandy wrecks our part of the world. Okay, we'll deal with it, but not if it's wrecking someplace else, even if the carbon that's destabilizing the Earth came primarily from those of us in these shores. Mm.
Nancy on Facebook, back to the Keystone for a moment, asks why a pipeline is being pushed instead of building a refining plant closer to the tar sand mining. She says, I would prefer more solar power and renewables, but wonder about the reasoning of those involved on the pipeline side of energy production.
Because they don't want to spend the money to do it, and they've already got these refineries that they own down in the Gulf of Mexico, so they just as soon take it there. Mm.
Sharon in Berlin. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. Man, this is a topic dear to my heart. Number one, first, I'd just like to draw your attention to, it's right along this line, but a tremendous article in National Geographic this month on coal, which also is leaving the earth desolate when they have the open pit mines. A couple of points that I haven't heard you say, but they were on an NPR program, I think maybe the other night, not too long ago, or maybe the other morning. It's dangerous to ship the crude oil in railroad cars because, one, our railroad cars are not substantial enough to keep it safe should they have any kind of a crash or anything like that. Ours are too lightweight, and it will spill, and they don't know how to clean it up. And they were also talking about shipping it to the Twin Ports through Superior, and that they would then take it across the Great Lakes in ships or in a pipeline. What happens if it spills? Well, we don't know yet. We haven't figured out a way to clean it up. This could be devastation to the fishing industry and maybe even some of the shipping and certainly the aquatic life and the fishing industry. People, this week is the first time I've heard clear across television and radio and other aspects that, oh, my gosh, we've got climate change, and maybe that's going to cause a problem. And they poo-pooed it up to this time.
Hmm. Bill?
Well, I mean, the caller is absolutely right. You really do not want this stuff spilling into the Ogallala Aquifer or into the Great Lakes or into your rivers, or you don't want it spilling any damn place. The only place it's safe is where it is and where it has been for the last many million years, underground in Alberta. And that's the only safe place for it for the planet, too. Think of this analogy. 20-some years ago, scientists figured out that if the Amazon rainforest got cut down, really the Earth wouldn't work very well anymore, that it was, as they said, the lungs of the planet. That was bad news because it was coming down at a rapid rate to make money for some Brazilians. But once we had that recognition of the science, the world kind of turned to Brazil and said, could you please stop cutting down the rainforest? And oddly enough, sort of against all expectations, the Brazilians have done not a perfect job, but a not bad job of slowing down that destruction. The tar sands of Canada or the big coal deposits of the Powder River Basin in this country are exactly the same thing. The world needs them to stay where they are, underground. And it would be a great gift if the citizens of the U.S. or Canada made sure that they stayed there. The only difference between this example and the one of Brazil is that Brazil people are poor, so it was hard for them to do this. We're not poor. We got plenty of other things that we can be doing to make decent living. And we should be doing them, and shame on us if instead all we can think of at this point in our history to power our lives is to dig up some more black stuff and burn it.
Bill McKibben is our guest this hour, author, environmentalist. His book in 1989, The End of Nature, was the first book for a general audience about climate change. He has been working on the issue ever since. His latest book is Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Impressively, he has built this organization, 350.org. It is a planet-wide climate change movement, and they have had 20,000 actions, demonstrations, as you heard him say, in every country on earth except for North Korea. So here's how you reach us. We've been really crowded. I'm sorry if you're having a hard time getting through, but you can right now, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter, @KDunnShow, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. A couple people here. Let's read some more emails that have come in. Here's somebody who was concerned about how Dr. James Hansen was treated as he testified on climate change before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, concerned about Senator Ron Johnson. Dr. Hansen made a point, Judy writes, that a true climate tax on sources of carbon in the atmosphere would mean that tar sands would be the first thing off the table. And then she was wondering why Johnson, as a former businessman, and people in the business community wouldn't see huge business opportunities and money opportunities in sustainable energy. Why don't they?
Some who do, and if we move into renewable energy, there's a lot of wealth to be made. The trouble is that the people who have yet to make their wealth doing something don't yet own senators and congressmen. It's people who made their wealth in the last century with oil and coal and gas who own congresspeople. So, 50 years from now, probably the wind industry will own a few congresspeople and they'll be doing their best to stamp out tidal power or, whatever comes next. But for the moment, it's the fossil fuel industry with a hammerlock on Washington. And you can see that. I mean, our most eminent climate scientists go up and testify on Capitol Hill and year after year after year. And our senators and congressmen pay them precious little attention.
Sharon is next in Minocqua, Bill. Hi, Sharon.
Yes. Hi. First off, thank you very much for this conversation. And it's such a great honor and a privilege to be speaking with Mr. McKibben. I have actually kind of a two-part question. The first part is it's a little bit disturbing that a lot of the conversation still focuses on energy production rather than energy conservation. There still is so much more that we can do in this country to conserve energy, and yet we waste so much of it. Every time I drive down University Avenue and go past the university and see all the steam billowing out of the building, I cringe. The second part of the question is also about the fossil fuel industry. It's not just about providing energy because there's so many other byproducts related to it. We extract fossil fuels, we use it as energy, but the byproducts then go into the manufacturing of many other materials. And so I just was wondering about Mr. McKibben's thoughts on how to move away from that type of an economy as well.
Let's get a response, Bill.
Sure. I mean, yes, there are manufacturing processes that rely on byproducts of fossil fuels. And in fact, those are probably the thing for which, if we're going to keep using, say, natural gas or fossil fuel, that we, at least for the time being, need to keep spending those on, not on, driving huge SUVs around the countryside. As to the point about conservation, it's absolutely correct. And I think that it's the clearest reason, or one of them, why we badly need a price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the atmosphere. Since for the moment, the fossil fuel industry is allowed to pour out that carbon for free and heat the planet, even though it's going to cause grave economic damage, it already is. Because of that, there's no incentive beyond kind of moral fervor for people to reduce energy use. And moral fervor is a very good thing, but so far we haven't been able to summon up enough of it to make a huge difference. I think that the moment when we get really serious about conservation is the moment when there's a price on carbon, and that'll be that's the one thing that every economist, left, right, and center, has said we should be doing, and it's the one thing that the fossil fuel industry has made sure doesn't happen.
Hmm. You have written recently, Bill, you asked the question, can Obama stand up to the oil industry, and then you say to an increasingly disillusioned environmental movement, Keystone looks like a last chance.
I think that it'll be incredibly telling. But I think that even if Obama approves Keystone, we can't let it be the moment that this movement ends. It'll help us understand that we can't count on Washington in any way, but that we need to take, that even the president isn't strong enough to stand up to the fossil fuel industry. That's why this divestment movement with colleges and churches and foundations and individuals getting rid of their fossil fuel stocks has been so powerful in the last year, why it's spread so quickly. It's a way for the rest of us to take directly on the most malign forces in our society. We're not going to give up, but boy, winning this battle over Keystone would be a nice sign that at least once in a while, people power can stand up to money power. Look, it's easy to despair and think that money power has just triumphed in the wake of Citizens United and a dozen other things. It would be awfully nice to understand that mere people and mere science and mere reason might once in a while triumph over the totalizing power of money. And we'll see.
Let's go to Pat in Duluth. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I want to thank Bill for his books and his excellent work for all of us and all the sacrifices he's making for us. And I live in Duluth, and both mayors from Duluth and Superior are in agreement that the pipeline is good here on Lake Superior. But I wanted to mention just something more hopeful. And as I'm sitting here, I'm gathering stuff up for a class I'm doing tonight on pollinators in the garden. And those are basically bees and wasps that I'll be focusing on. And I gave a version of this class over a decade ago, and people came to the class, and they wanted to actually know how to get rid of them and kill these insects. And so tonight, the fact that I can do another version of this class, and people are actually coming to learn how to attract them, protect them, and provide habitat for them, it just gives me a lot of hope when many times I end up reading things and just get really upset.
That makes my day to hear that. That's a really good reminder, and it's a reminder that, among other things, even when we're down and depressed a little bit about the prospects for change, it does bear going outside and into the larger world and at least looking at and appreciating all the beauty that is around us and hoping it'll power us up. And, you know, I love bees myself, and they've had a tough go of it these last years. They're kind of a reminder of trouble in some ways, but boy, their perseverance and their energy and their stick-to-itiveness should be an example to all of us going forward.
Thank you, Pat. Time for one more call. Katie in northern Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I'm just a meager follower, I guess. I read Bill's book, Deep Economy, when I was at school in Stevens Point a few years ago, and I just wanted to thank him for 350.org and for paving the way for new conservation-minded people.
Thank you so much for saying that. The good news about this movement we're building is that it's a new kind of movement. It's basically one without leaders. Because we have the Internet, we can be connected sort of like bees in a hive in all kinds of new ways, and that's very, very good news. It doesn't depend on me or anybody else. It depends on all of us in collaboration, and maybe, just maybe, we'll be sprawling enough to match the sprawling fossil fuel industry and bring it to heel.
Thanks, Katie. Bill, thank you so much for being with us, as always.
Well, my pleasure. Happy Earth Month. And I'll talk to you sometime before too long.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Bill McKibben, author, environmentalist. His latest book is Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. He founded 350.org, which is worth looking at, and his 1989, a very important book, The End of Nature, the first book for a lay audience about climate change. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls and your emails and your Facebook messages. We have news coming up, and we'll return with another hour.